Glad you're here this evening. Let's get started on a subject that I've looked forward to. This is not like my favorite subject, but it's close. And it is regarding what is commonly known as textual criticism. Now, the word criticism doesn't mean be judgy. It means, essentially, it means research or analysis. So another word would be textual analysis. When you go through the process of trying to understand anything that you've read, there are two things that you have to examine. The first is, what is the text? What is the text? Is it reliable? Does it represent what the author intended it to represent? A clear example of this would be, and I'll mention this a little bit later, would be the plays of Shakespeare. Do you know that we have none of the original manuscripts of William Shakespeare's plays? None of them. And in fact, because they have not been retained in history, simply because they've been used so much, used in copying. Now, Shakespeare's plays were written after the printing press was utilized. So you would think that there would be so many copies of them that we would have no doubt about what Shakespeare's plays really say, but in fact, we don't. There are gaps in Shakespeare's plays that textual critics analyze based upon word usage, style, context, and available ancillary material, other things that he's written to fill in those gaps. And so when you pick up your English literature book in college or graduate school, wherever, and you're reading these plays of Shakespeare, know that they are not the original. They are the best work of textual critics to supply the original. So it's a favorite subject of mine. The second issue when it comes to reading a text, not only do you want to know what the text is, what is it? That's what the textual critic does. He or she determines what the text actually is. But then the second responsibility of someone seeking to understand a text is to discern or determine what the text means. You cannot understand what the text means if you do not understand what the text says. Does that make sense? You have any questions? Because we're going to set the plow now, and we're going down, all right? And I hope you find this beneficial. We're going to spend at least 2 weeks on this because it is that, well, we're going to answer two questions. The first question tonight is the question, how we know the text is accurate. That's part one of this study of the reliability of the New Testament text. How do we know that the text is accurate? And then next week, we're going to look at the question, why do the manuscripts read differently? Why are there variances in the manuscripts that we possess? So, are you ready to go? All right. How do we know that the text is accurate? Number one, through the study of textual criticism. Through the study of textual criticism. In the first century, when the New Testament was written, there was one international language, and that language was a form of Greek known as Koine, K-O-I-N-E, Koine, which simply means common Greek, common Greek. Now, of all these books in the New Testament, all the books in the New Testament, well, I'll go ahead and add to that, and all the books in the Old Testament, we do not have any original manuscripts. We do not have any manuscripts written by Moses or Isaiah or Matthew or Paul or John. None of them. The reason was asked earlier, why? The question was asked, why? And the answer is, most likely, just the flourishing of copies being made. Every time a document is handled, and we're not talking about, we'll get to it, we're not talking about paper like we use today, but just imagine if you were using a copy on paper of a document. You didn't have a photographic machine. You couldn't Xerox it. You couldn't even mimeograph it. How many of you remember getting high on mimeograph paper in school? Well, I hated it when we quit using those at churches. That was sometimes the only good breath I got during the day was a breath of mimeograph paper. But that document that you have is passed along from somebody who's reading it, who's used it to copy in low light, limited light, handled, picked up, looked at closely to make sure that they're copying it correctly, put down. If you just handled that one page of that document for, let's say, 50 years, and someone was dealing with that document every day for 50 years to try to duplicate it, to try to make sure that this word is distributed to people everywhere the gospel is going, everywhere the church is expanding. If you were doing that, how long do you think that piece of paper would last before it began to be tattered and words began to disappear? And chunks out of that paper began to disintegrate. Not long. And so before long, it's believed, we don't know this, but before long, it's believed that those documents simply disintegrated. And when you understand the type of material on which they were written, it will make more sense. We don't have any what are called autographs, originals. That is what the author actually used. So we use this practice called textual criticism. If I started over here in this area, say with Hector, if I were to whisper something in your ear, just something, three words, do you think that when we got all the way back there, the same three words would be repeated if we whispered it one to another? Whispered it. Not likely, is it? You've all played that game, haven't you? And it can sometimes end up being something so far-fetched that you can't imagine how in the world that what started this way ended up that way. How is that even possible? Now, you might think that writing would solve that problem. But just imagine if I walked over to Hector and I handed him a piece of paper and I said, Hector, in your own writing style, don't try to emulate mine, but in your own writing style, write what I have written and then pass it on. Don't say a word. Just pass it on. Do you think that there might be changes in what I handed to Hector And what would end up back here in Jason's hands? Why? Say that again. Interpretate. Why would you have to interpret if it's just three little words?
It may mean something different to me than it does those.
Okay, so you're saying that whoever's doing the writing is perhaps implanting a different perspective. Why would they do that? Why would they do that? Why not just simply make it clearer? Let me say something. I think these are excellent observations, and if we deal with interpretation any time in the future, we're going to deal with that. But we will one day when we cover the subject of hermeneutics. But for now, hear this. We all write differently. I mean, I suspect that everybody in this room, maybe an exception, but I would suspect everybody in this room knows how to write in cursive. Right? How many of your grandchildren know how to write in cursive? Huh? You think they all do? You think any of them do? Now listen. If there's nobody there to say what that word is, then what is the transcriber left to do? Guess. They just guess. Now, hopefully they do it with an educated kind of guess, some informed kind of guess, but not necessarily. Now, wait. What about when we start taking that piece of paper that I wrote three words on and I put five different languages in this audience and I want it to end up back there having transferred through five different languages before it gets back to Jason? What do you think the likelihood is that it will end up exactly what I said or exactly what I wrote? It's slim, isn't it? It's very slim. So now you, I think, begin to see some of the difficulties that are faced by textual critics, because while we don't have any of the original documents, what we have are copies, and frankly, they are likely copies of copies of copies of copies that we have of the New Testament. So this is the study of textual criticism. Now let me talk about the necessity of textual criticism. I've already somewhat covered it, but I just want to list three reasons we have to rely upon textual critics. Number one, because we don't possess any of the original writings. And all the things I just described are real. They really happen. Secondly, movable type was not invented until the 15th century. The first thing printed on Gutenberg's press was a copy of the Latin Bible, somewhere between 1452 and 1456. So think about this with me. Somewhere around 1600 years or 600 years ago, somewhere around 600 years ago, all of the documents were written by hand. The handwritten documents of the New Testament that are in the Greek language are called manuscripts. And third, there is an abundance of material to be examined. In fact, I'll say it now, probably repeat it, we have in possession by we, I meaning current places and people, because many of these are privately owned. Some of them are publicly owned by governments. They fill libraries, museums, the Vatican. We have some 5,500 manuscripts. So let's talk a little bit about how textual criticism is done. The practice of textual criticism. Now, most ancient manuscripts or most ancient writings have the slimmest manuscript evidence by which scholars can somehow attempt to establish the original text, what it actually was. Homer's writings that are contemporary to some degree with the New Testament, to some degree with the Old Testament, these writings outside the Bible have very thin evidence. For the most part, they are guesswork. But not so for the Bible, and especially not so for the New Testament. We have enormous evidence. And it can all be broken down into three categories. Okay? All that we have can be broken down into three categories. First are the Greek manuscripts that I've already mentioned. And of these Greek manuscripts, there are four different kinds of Greek manuscripts. There is the papyri. The papyri. And it's named after the kind of material that it was written on. It was a very cheap writing material. It's the word. Papyri is the Greek word from which we get the word paper. But it was a particular kind of vegetation that was used. And actually, this word is in the New Testament itself. And in 2 John verse 12, it says, "Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk face to face so that our joy may be complete." That word paper, it's another word. It's not papyri, but it refers to papyrus. It's the Greek word kartes, which we get the word card from, or chart even. It's extremely perishable. It survives only in warm weather and only in dry climates. In fact, we're fortunate, or blessed, I should say, to have any papyrus fragments available today. And these papyri fragments contain some of the earliest witnesses or the earliest evidence of what was the original text. Every one of our papyri originated before 300 AD. Before, not after. Now remember, when was the last book that's included in the New Testament written? 90, 95. Some say the Gospel of John and the Book of Revelation were written rather simultaneously or successively. So they both date late in the first century. So if all of our Greek papyri manuscripts are from before 300 AD, do you think that's a lot of time? A century? I mean, we think of it, this is America. A century. I mean, some people live to be a century old, don't they? I mean, they're around. So let's say they wrote something when they were 6. And they lived to be 100. They could tell you what they wrote. That's what I wrote. We have no idea, really, when John the Apostle died. What we do know is there were people who outlived him, who cited him, who quoted him, who said, he said this. So well into the second century, there were people who were concurrently alive with the Apostle John. I'm just bringing that up to show you that what sounds like 100 years, technology wasn't moving at its rate today. And during that 100 years, the same writing models were used, the same uses, the same quills, and the same material on which it was written. At the turn, at the beginning of the 20th century, we only possessed 9 papyrus fragments that contained any part of the New Testament. Now, however, there are some 115 and counting. I didn't bring a Greek New Testament. I thought I started to, but in a Greek New Testament, you have a line, a demarcation line. The Greek text is above it. Below it is what's called the critical apparatus. Not the judgmental apparatus, but the analyzing apparatus. In it, you can find, in that critical apparatus, you can find every variation that exists in every manuscript we possess. The papyrus, one kind of Greek handwritten manuscript. The second kind are called unseals. Unseal manuscripts. These unseal manuscripts are our second line of evidence to reconstruct the New Testament. If you want to know, they're not only called unseals, they're also called majuscules. They're big. They're big letters. I'll tell you what they are. They're capital letters. They're all capital letters. And the reason capital letters were used was for precision. They required more precision than other styles of writing. Now, that being said, in unseal manuscripts, there was absolutely no punctuation. Nor was any space included between the words or the paragraphs. Why? That's right. Even though some of this material on which it was written was cheap, it wasn't free. And so space was reserved. And because of the precision of the Greek language, it's very easy to distinguish one word from another, to tell where one word ends and another begins. And it's also because of the precision or inflection of the Greek language, it is also very easy to insert the necessary punctuation. These uncial manuscripts were written primarily between the 4th and the 10th centuries. We do have five fragmentary uncial manuscripts from the 3rd century, but the rest are from the 4th. By the way, uncial manuscripts were not written on Greek papyri. They were written on animal skins. And we have at least three full manuscripts of the New Testament in uncial. One of them also contains the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint. If you have a New Scofield Reference Bible, for instance. How many of you use Scofield? Anybody in here? Yeah, we got some hang-ons. Good. In the New Scofield Reference Bible, back in the 70s, when it came out, new, it would often cite where any one of these three particular manuscripts were used, or they would identify what those manuscripts said. And they were all called one of these three: Alexandrinus, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus. Who said that? Well done, sir. Sinaiticus. Very good. The third Greek manuscript type that we have are called minuscules. Minuscules. David, did you take Greek?
Yeah, but
I don't have to ask you. Well, he's not here to defend himself, but you learned Greek in minuscules, lowercase letters. More precisely than calling them lowercase letters, they are in fact cursive. They are cursive letters, but they're not connected. They're cursive unconnected letters. It was a faster way to duplicate material. Books, documents could be turned out quicker. The minuscule mode of writing was used from the 9th century until the 16th century. And we have approximately 2,800 minuscule or cursive manuscripts that are known to exist. Now the fourth kind of Greek manuscript that we have will fall under a category known as lectionaries. Lectionaries. Now, the church followed a similar pattern to the synagogue in its routine weekly act of worship. There was a fixed portion of the law read in the synagogue every week. So the Christian church emulated that by establishing a fixed portion of both the law, the Old Testament, and the New Testament to read every week. Those fixed portions are known as lectionaries. And those lectionaries obviously contained biblical text. So these lectionaries date back as early as the 6th century A.D. And we have found complete lectionary manuals in total, all together, from the 8th century. There are 2,300 lectionary manuscripts extant, still existing. Of that 2,300, about 300 of the lectionary manuscripts were written in the uppercase, the uncial case. The rest were written in minuscule case. So let me just review that for your sake. You might want to make these notes alongside in your notes there. In uncials, regarding uncials, we have about 300 uncial manuscripts. With respect to minuscule manuscripts, we have 2,813. With respect to lectionaries, we have 2,281 lectionaries, all or part. And of papyri, we have 120. That makes a total of 5,500 plus or minus. Well, like I said, they would be found in museums. The British Museum possesses some. Egypt. In Alexandria, the Great Museum possesses some. The Vatican possesses some. We possess some. Southwestern Seminary, which I was privileged to serve for almost 20 years, has some. They're just distributed. Yes.
Are any in Greece?
Well, Alexandria. Yes. I mean, not in Greece. The answer to that question is I have no idea.
I wasn't going to call you.
I said Alexandria. That's Egypt. I'm sorry. By the way, you called me on something last week, and you were, I think you did. Maybe it wasn't you. No, it wasn't you. Somebody commented, you said the sun, and I may have said the sun is 4.5 light years away from the earth, and that's not true. I meant the nearest star outside our solar system, Alpha Centauri, is 4.5 light years. That's 4.5 years traveling at the speed of light. Anyway, that's, I don't know how I got onto that, but I just don't want to be completely uncorrected. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Some of them are, actually. You can find a picture of almost every one of the papyri. Those just are of most interest to people. Again, if you were looking in the apparatus, the critical apparatus in a Greek New Testament, you can identify each kind of document. There is a style for each kind of document. For all of the papyri, it begins with a P and then the number.
What is the Isaiah thing that they
do? I don't know.
What
are you talking about? You'll have to help me here. Oh, yes. The Dead Sea Scrolls, which were found in 1946 or 7 or 8, along there, were found in an Essene camp alongside the Dead Sea, obviously. And they were found in caves, in clay jars. These were collections of documents that related to the Hebrew faith. And they contain Old Testament material. They're not in any of this consideration. No, not in any of this consideration. No. They were vellum, and they were scrolls, so they were a paper product. So yes, like the papyri.
But they didn't add any to the known New Testament.
No, they didn't add to the known Old Testament either. Okay. They simply confirmed and gave. Many of them, or some of them, took us back in time, closer to the writing of the Old Testament. Those are good questions, and I'm sorry, Old Testament's not my thing. I mean, I love it, but it's not my thing. So, I felt like this information, that I already had quite a bit of, you know, detail on, would suffice. I said that we had three different categories in which this evidence could be lumped, one being Greek manuscripts that we've just talked about, and four different ways to categorize them. Then the second category of New Testament textual material that takes us back are what would be called versions. What version do you use? Oh, that's a hymnal, brother. That's no version. That's a Scofield. No, that's an NIV. You use this version, the NIV, but this is a version, which means this is a translation from the original language into the receptor language, English. What is this one? What version is this one? This is the Legacy Standard Bible. Now, I know zero about the Legacy Standard Bible, but I'm going to tell you about it very quickly because it's all here on these pages we skip through very quickly. It is translated by a company called the Lockman Foundation, who also translated the New American Standard Bible. Let's see. It is a translation, which means it does the same thing that the New International Version does, and the New American Standard Bible does, and the English Standard Version. It goes back to original manuscripts and translates from them into our language today. Now, why would we need this many translations? There's a Holy Bible. An NIV. Does anybody have a King James Bible? Okay. And that was published in 1611. The first one was published in 1611. The Authorized Version, as it's called. Why would we need this many English translations? Don't you know the language? Don't we all speak the same language? You have heard people from England speak, haven't you? They speak English, sort of. They speak a kind of English. What about Australia? You know, they speak English too. No, it's English. Did you know that in South Africa, they speak English too? Some of them, not.
Which version do you think is the most accurate?
Now, that's a great question for another day. That is a great question, but for another day. But let me tell you why. You know it. You do not speak the same way they spoke in 1611. Words, by usage, change meanings. Not only that, grammar changes style. The meaning? Okay, I want you to, Miss Erla, I'm not gonna ask you your age, but I'm just gonna say you're 50, okay? I'm not going to do this. You're 50 years old. You're 50 years old. So 50 years ago, let's say, you were given your first Bible at birth, and somebody from a church came and gave you a Bible, and it was a King James version of the Bible because that's what everybody used back then for the most part, even though the Revised Standard Version was out by then. But I digress. When you read the King James Version of the Bible, when you were old enough to read, say, 5, 6, 7, whatever age you started reading, even then, that wasn't your language.
Did you really understand it?
That's right. That's a great, good observation. That wasn't your language then. And your language has changed in these 50 years alone. I remember when it was one thing to be gay, and now it's another thing to be gay. I'm not belittling it. I'm just noting it. And that's just one smidgen. Every year, Merriam-Webster produces a new dictionary. Why? Right.
Change the meaning of some of the words.
New words, change meanings of words. The Oxford English Dictionary, the British, same thing. Every year. So, for this reason, there are versions. Because as soon as the church began to penetrate into areas where Greek was not the most common language, those taking the gospel attempted to translate into the language of the people they were trying to reach. Even if they didn't reproduce the whole Bible, which would have been a painstaking job, they would reproduce portions of it. And so we possess some of these versions. I won't bore you by all the versions, but we have a lot of them. In fact, about 30,000 of these versions exist. So, textual critics reserve the term manuscript for those items that we have that are written in the original language, Greek. And they use this term, versions, for the translation from the original language to a receptor language. You know what I mean when I say receptor? Okay. I need to stop sometime soon, so I'll just throw some things at you that I think might be of interest to you. When it comes to the number of pieces of evidence we have for the meaning and the text of the New Testament, we have a ridiculously high amount of evidence. We are not guessing at one single word. Not one. We know what every word is because of the comparative analysis of textual critics. Now, that being said, there remain questions. There really are about three major discrepancies among textual critics, not in the Bible, but in textual criticism. They refer to portions of the New Testament that some argue, don't belong there. I guess the most famous one is the long ending of the Gospel of Mark. Everything from verse 9 through verse 20 in the 16th chapter of Mark's Gospel, most, not all, most textual critics believe was inserted at a later time and found its way into some manuscripts. Now, manuscripts have a heritage like an individual has a heritage. They were copies of something. And so it's not unusual to find in a particular area of the world a lot of copies that look alike, because they were likely copied. And this is the issue. This is the issue. Some manuscript lineages bear evidence of Mark 16, 9 through 20. Well, one area of the world manifests Mark 16, 9 through 20, while strains, lineages from other parts of the world do not. So that's one reason textual critics think it should be left out. But even there, we have no doubt what the words actually are. We don't have any doubt about it. We know exactly what the words are. There is enough evidence. Okay? Now, there are two other passages. I'm not going to digress. I'm going to move on. There are two other passages you don't need to know tonight. We may deal with them at the end, but just to give you an example. Passages. No, not books. No book problems. No book problems. There are some who think the book of James, and some who thought the book of Revelation should not be included, but our manuscript evidence for both of those books is unsurpassed. We have no doubt what the original document said. I wasn't going to say. Thank you, Randy.
The woman caught in adultery in section of 1 John.
That's correct, but let's just drop it for now. I don't want to get into a theology issue, but that's going to force me into a theology discussion. So I need to get done. I'm going to get done. The third category of evidence, and we'll close with this, is the writings of the church fathers. The writings of the church fathers. If we didn't have a single manuscript, if we did not have a single manuscript, the entire New Testament could be recreated by the writings of the early church fathers. I'm talking about from the end of the first century through the third century, or the portions of the early fourth century, up through what we call the Council of Nicaea. The writings of the early church fathers. For example, we have seven letters that survived, written by a man named Ignatius of Antioch. Ignatius of Antioch lived to be 40 years of age. He lived between 70 AD. Did you hear me? 70 AD. Do you know anybody in the New Testament that lived to be to 70 AD?
John.
Maybe Timothy. Maybe Mark. It's believed that the earliest text written in the New Testament was 1 Thessalonians and or Galatians at or around 50 AD. Everything else was written after that. All of the Gospels were written after that. So bear in mind, this guy lived from 70 AD to 110 AD, and we have seven letters that he wrote. And in those letters, he quotes from 18 different books of the New Testament. We can find every text he cites. That's pretty amazing when you consider the fact there was no printing press. There was no copying machine. This was being done by hand at what we would call a snail's pace, and yet copies of what would become the New Testament are already well known outside of Palestine. Just remarkable. It's just remarkable. All right. I said I would perhaps refer to Shakespeare again. He wrote 37 plays in the 17th century. They were all written after the invention of the printing press. Not one of his documents, original documents, exists. In every one of Shakespeare's plays, there are gaps where we do not know what he wrote. No one can efficiently fill in the blanks, although textual scholars are not without ego. In the 16th century, when the printing press came about, the New Testament had been written 1,600 years before that. For still most of the New Testament's history, the human hand was the copying device of the New Testament. And yet, we have much better evidence for what the original texts said than we do for Shakespeare, because we haven't had to fill in any blanks in any of our documents. A current day scholar named Michael Holmes, he's a PhD from Princeton, and he teaches at Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota, put it this way: the sheer volume of the information available to the New Testament critic makes it practically certain that the original text has been preserved somewhere among the surviving witnesses. Frederick Kenyon wrote the following: the number of manuscripts of the New Testament, of early translations from it, and of quotations from it in the oldest writers of the church is so large that it is practically certain that the true reading of every doubtful passage is preserved in some one or other of these ancient authorities. This can be said of no other book in the world. And think about this. Early on, the Christian church divided. Y'all familiar with that? You know enough church history to know that the church divided? We call it the Catholic Church, right? Why do we do that? If there was only one church, why do we call it anything? Because it identified itself. It identified itself to demark it from that other church that split from it. Anybody know the name of it? I'm sorry? No. No, it was long before that. The Greek Orthodox Church. And so, early on, skeptics would look at the other to examine the credibility of their sources. This has never been a process without scrutiny. Keep that in mind. Your New Testament is the most reliable document handed down from ancient history that exists. Every word of it is accounted for in the evidence that we possess. Any questions?
What about some of the books that the other churches have?
Okay, I'll answer that question. That's a great question. For instance, the Catholic Church, their Bible will possess 16 or 17 books in between the Testaments. Those are sometimes called the Apocrypha. They, the Catholic Church, acknowledges they are suspicious. They are not included in their Bible as Scripture. They're included in their Bible as history. Because there is some validation even from these questionable texts. Does that make sense? Well, the Reformers saw no purpose in that. In fact, utterly rejected that practice because of the way people, if it's in this book, we believe it. Well, the church fathers didn't believe it, but they didn't deny the existence of the material. And folks, we can find some validating use for even what I will call not apocryphal material, but pseudepigraphal material. That is, books that were written by people claiming to be someone they weren't. They still may be useful. Just a point of great question. Anybody else? Well, it wouldn't even be considered an ancient document. Yeah, it's not even an ancient document. Anything else? Anybody else? Anyone else? Okay, next week we're going to look at the issue of the variances. Why so many variations? Why don't the manuscripts all say the same thing? I bet you already have some ideas. But ponder those. And we'll dig into it more carefully next week, okay? Lord, we thank you for the Word. While it isn't you, it's one of the best ways we can know you. So we're thankful for it. We love it because we love you. But we wouldn't know you without it. We are thankful for the way it's been guarded. And we believe it was by your divine providence that it has been so guarded, so that today we can trust it, every bit of it. For giving our faith a firm foundation, we close by saying praise to the God of the Word. Amen.